I'm Sayer, and I love Marvel.
And I'm Kaylee, and I love someone who loves Marvel.
And we're watching through the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe, or MCU, in release order.
There's another order?
For Kaylee's first time.
And Sayer's 85th.
Welcome to MCU.
And me! Okay, we got it.
In this episode, we're discussing 2013's Iron Man 3. And fair warning, there will be spoilers.
Tony's questioning a lot of things, and he's suffering from anxiety after the whole showdown in New York City where he flew through the portal and came back to Earth. His home gets destroyed. He goes to Tennessee, meets a cute kid. What's Tony like without his suit? Well, now we find out. There's a terrorist, but it's actually just an actor, and it's Val Kilmer's cousin instead, who is the real baddie. And there's a big battle somewhere on an oil rig off the coast of Florida? We don't know. And a bunch of suits arrive to help Tony save the president. And Pepper almost dies, but she doesn't. And then Tony blows up all the suits. I find it hard to sum that up. It was pretty convoluted. And maybe it's very, very satisfying.
It's funny. I actually find this one works as a standalone pretty well. I mean, we all have a relationship with Tony now from all the other films. And this film does deal with his PTSD from New York. So if you haven't seen The Avengers, then you don't know why he's having these panic attacks. But I really enjoyed it. I had a fun time in this one. I think that we get a look at Tony. Well, it's funny because you said at one point in the film, what was the question you asked? Like,
I think I said, who is Tony without his suit?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Thor without his suit is still super strong.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen Black Widow kick some ass without a suit.
Captain
America is super strong. Hulk just needs to get perturbed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's Iron Man is the one, it seems so far, whose superpower is his genius,
mm-hmm.
which in a fight where you need brute strength is not an asset necessarily.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing to see him make do on the fly and to not have access to all his wealth and his gadgets.
Yeah.
And his voice command. What's his name?
Jarvis,
that he has to kind of make do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, his genius is his superpower. You're so right. And so you could say that's enough. He has all his Iron Man suits. But his genius, when he has all of his wealth and tech around him, becomes a bit of a catch-all.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a suit for every scenario. He has a suit hiding in every closet.
Well, yeah, there are endless suits, too. That's the thing that this movie has shown. Because in the first film,
there's
we see the
one
and the creation of the first suit, and then he improves upon it. And
you're never really worried because you're always like, oh, well, some gadget's going to come out of somewhere. So it was funny because you asked, who is Tony without his suits? What use is he?
I think right when he got to Tennessee and was in the snow.
Yeah.
And then my question was answered.
Within 5 minutes. Like, mm-hmm. oh, we're going to see it in this film. And that's what I really enjoy about this one, is that they take him out of his suit and you get to see him be crafty and use his genius to create little gadgets. Like when he goes and storms the place that Ben Kingsley is living with this like grab bag of tasers and stuff that he's created from junk. And I really like that mixed with him reckoning with these panic attacks that he's like, me? What? Why am I having panic attacks? The first one he has where he gets into the suit and he asks Jarvis to do a scan. Like, is it the heart? Is it the brain? And Jarvis says, no, sir, I think you've suffered a severe panic attack. And he's in disbelief about it. But I like when he says, you go through these things and then they just disappear and you're left wondering what it was and what it was all for and what happened. And aliens came, like aliens came to New York, mm-hmm. and he flew a missile through a wormhole into outer space and blew up an alien ship. Like, it was nothing in the film. You know, he came back down and then he was like, oh, let's get shawarma. So I'm really glad that they dealt with that. Like, that's a crazy thing to have happen.
And maybe his cavalier attitude is kind of creeping up on him in a way where, you know, he stuffs things down and always has a comeback and a line for everything. And so we get to see a little bit more of the cracks. Mm-hmm. My favorite scenes were with the kid. That kid stole the movie.
He's great.
And just their chemistry is really great. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the kid saves Tony at one point.
Yeah. And he's a good foil for Tony, too, because he's like, okay, so you're anxious about New York. Yeah, it's crazy. Tell me about what happened. Do you think your anxiety is related to it? So your suit's broken. You're a mechanic. Fix it. Mm-hmm. Figure it out. And I like how practical he is in sort of pushing Tony. And mm-hmm. it's funny to see them needling each other. You know, him, the kid saying, you're leaving me just like my dad.
Yeah.
And Tony's like, you can't guilt trip me
here. Yeah. I wish a little suit came out and they could fight together.
Well, in the comics, at one point, Iron Man did get a sidekick called Iron Lad.
No. Yes. I want to watch that film. I'd watch a trilogy of that. Iron Lad?
Iron Lad.
Oh, is he in a kilt?
No. An iron kilt? I like in the beginning when Tony does shoot the suit onto Pepper, and it's not just she's protected now, she actually does, like, she saves him and then she saves Maya, Rebecca Hall, and she actually does some heroics in this. And then at the end of the film, she ultimately defeats Killian.
Yeah, she definitely gets more to do. I appreciated that she has a bigger role.
Oh, actually, her having a more heroic role in the film was a direct result of, in an early draft of the script, Maya, Rebecca Hall's character, was ultimately going to be Killian. She was going to be the ultimate villain. But, and this is where the whole money thing comes into play. At this time, Marvel was about to team up with, I believe it was McDonald's, to do a toy line. And they were going to use this film to release a bunch of toys. And the corporate level of Marvel, when they read the initial script, they said, no, a female villain toy isn't going to sell. It has to be a man.
Please.
Exactly. And so Shane Black, he's gone on record saying that's what happened. And so he and Kevin Feige were like, all right, well, then Pepper's going to have a more heroic role to play in it then. So they tried to counterbalance a little bit. And Maya still had some stuff to do. Like, I'm glad they didn't just cut her. They kind of made her a supplementary evil character.
I don't see her as evil. I see that her invention or her discovery was used for the purposes that she didn't intend. But are we supposed to think at the beginning, when they get in the elevator, that Maya and Killian know each other? Or is that when they meet? He's trying to...
Yeah, I think that's just...
That's when they meet?
I think that's just when they meet, and he is presenting this idea of AIM to them. Tony thinks that he's fawning over him, but he's like, oh, yeah, you're cool too, but I'm actually talking to Maya because her extremis idea is really cool, and I want to do something with it with my company. What'd you think of the bad guys in this, the whole extremis exploding hot people?
It's kind of demonic, I'm not going to lie. I found this film dark and pretty affecting, but I don't feel like it's for kids. It's kind of demonic and scary. But, you know, I like a classy villain. I like a Lex Luthor.
Sure. Well, that was kind of who Killian was, but then he also got super hot and breathed fire.
Yeah, we can't always have a whiskey-swilling millionaire genius with witty one-liners.
Much as we'd like to.
Oh, I love that. I love that trope.
Also, with the whole healing thing, that's always a tough one for me. When you're presented with a villain that can heal from anything.
How do you kill it?
How do you kill it? Mm-hmm. And so I start to lose a little bit of the stakes.
Yes, it's like I've said before, when it's an army of drones,
mm-hmm.
I don't care about the villains in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Or either if they die super easily, or if they, or if you don't understand the rules of how they die.
Mm-hmm.
But also, at the end, Tony's able to undo it. So there's some kind of antidote.
Yeah, that was a pretty quick fix. You know, mm-hmm. he rattles off some lines about 13 years ago. I almost had this figured out when I was drunk, so I should be able to do it now. It's like, oh, okay, all the problems are solved. Great.
Right. But yeah, it's a bit like, are they trying to assemble an army? I also found the Mandarin storyline a little convoluted for me.
Mm.
Because the baddie, who everyone thinks is the baddie, is not. He's a decoy. I'm not sure. It's, to me, like, I enjoyed this film as I was watching it. Each of the moments, each of the scenes, I was following and enjoying. But as a whole film, it felt very sequel-y to me.
Hmm.
I know it's the third mm-hmm. Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
But you made the good point while we were watching it. I brought up, like, when Tony was in Tennessee, where are the other Avengers?
Mm-hmm.
Do they care about each other? Are they checking in?
And that's the constant question in every subsequent film after the Avengers is, wait, why isn't everybody being called in on this? Why doesn't Nick Fury know about this?
Exactly. This is the first film we haven't had Samuel L. Jackson in.
Yeah, so it is a confusing thing. But the rationale that I think I cling to at this point is that even though we saw them as a team in the Avengers, they're not a response team yet. They're not like a mobile SWAT unit that Nick Fury can call in necessarily. Also, at the end of the Avengers, when he's talking to the panel of backlit screen people, he says, then we'll call them in and they'll come back because we need them to. So I think
this seems like a pretty big deal. The president was hanging from two chains.
That's a very good point.
It feels like the logic is just missing in this film. And so I'm curious as to why Iron Man 3 was made. Obviously money. We're going to say money. And it's an entertaining film, and more Robert Downey Jr., all these reasons. But was there a real impetus to make this film and this story to add to the canon?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, for down the line, will we reference what happened in this film? What kind of PTSD do all those people who fell out of the plane have?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
When they land in the water and they all just wave at him smiling, I'm like, oh no, they're fully freaked out. They just fell out of a plane, had to grab their friend's hands. Like, and these are either a bunch of like flight attendants or journalists or presidential staff. Like, they're just flying through the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, they need therapy. So I'm just curious about how, because you talk so much about how they all kind of converge into the Avengers films and the several Avengers movies.
Mm-hmm.
You said phase one of the Marvel films thus far, we just completed prior to Iron Man 3. And I felt like there was quite a build to the Avengers film.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're starting phase two. So I'm just curious, what do the Avengers know about what happened in the course of this film? But I guess it would be a little tacky too if we've been following Tony this whole film and then all of a sudden in the final battle, Captain shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Or some of his pals. But this is a logic thing that I have.
Yeah.
Just taking it at face value, I'm just curious what this adds to the greater storyline or canon
mm-hmm.
of the Marvel films.
Mm-hmm. What would you think that this brings to it? What did you take out of this? Like, did Tony learn something? Did we learn something about them? Did Pepper learn something? Like, what do you take out of this?
I think we're seeing Tony at his most vulnerable. And maybe he's realizing that his genius and his powers and his suits are not the be-all end-all and are not the deus ex machina. I actually liked at the end when he was fighting Killian and the suit comes flying in and it's the Mark 42 and it breaks apart. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And, you know, we are trained as an audience to expect that it's going to work out and mm-hmm. expect that the genius will prevail and that the suit will assemble and it'll be some big explosion and he'll kill Killian. And instead, It doesn't work. They keep fighting. He has to fight without his suit or just parts of his suit. And then it ends up being, as you said, Gwyneth Pepper, who takes down Killian.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if I'm like psychoanalyzing this film or something, I'd say he's gone through this dark night of the soul. He's suffering from things that have come before. He seems to be the type of person who's pretty glib and tosses things off and pretends nothing affects him. So maybe we're seeing Tony have a bit of a breakdown and have to rely on other people and have to, you know, it's not just him and robots anymore.
Mm.
He cares about Pepper. And then at the very end of the film, he has the girl, he has Pepper, but, you know, everything he's worked towards, all his cars, all his gadgets, you know, his mansion in Malibu, gone. You know, we didn't see that part of Tony.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see the billionaire playboy Tony in this one as much.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Tony making do. What do you think?
Well, something that I took away from the dialogue in this, the film starts and ends with him saying, "We create our own demons." And I think this film is a bit of a deconstruction of, for him, obviously his own demons, but he's starting to reconcile all of his past mistakes, and they're all starting to catch up with him. So we've seen that in Iron Man, in Iron Man 2, in the Avengers, and he's not done. I think that's what I see in this, is that he has led such a selfish, one-track mind kind of life that now that he's starting to make this pivot, it is not going to be a clean break. There is a lot of growing pain that he has to go through before he can get to some place of peace afterwards. Like, even at the beginning of this, where he thinks that he's sitting pretty, the Avengers happened, he saved the day, things are great with Pepper, he's killing it making all the suits, and yet he's still having these panic attacks, this PTSD, and he's become obsessive with building his suits. It's no longer just something that he's doing for protection or because he has to. He's doing it because he's compulsively doing it. And he's hiding behind it. He's using building the suits. Like at the end of the film, he says they weren't armor. They were a cocoon.
Mm.
But I think what I take most out of it is that we're digging even deeper into Tony's deconstruction of himself and his reformation into the man he wants to be. And for Pepper too. I mean, the necklace that he put around Pepper at the end, that's made of all the shrapnel that was in his heart.
Was I supposed to catch that?
How
do you know that?
I know that only because I've read the trivia, so I was looking for it.
Right, never would have known that.
No, and why would you? I wish that they had showcased it more, because I think it's a really neat symbol where he's taking this thing that's been surrounding his heart and he turns it into a gift for this person who has given his heart and his life new purpose, and it's given him, she's given him something to live for in a new, open, and healthy way.
I think that's a good analysis. I disagree that it's a good standalone film. Maybe it's the genre for me that I'm still not used to, where I can't follow many of the villains' intentions. I have found that through each of these films so far. Except, I think, in Captain America. And maybe that's because it was mirroring the Nazis and it was also taking place during war. But, so last night we watched Amadeus, and arguably Salieri is the villain.
Sure, yeah.
But he's so sympathetic. And it breaks my heart in two listening to him talk about how he feels about Mozart. But watching that film, or Hamilton, for example, we were talking about, or Jesus Christ Superstar, where the villain, whoever leads to the protagonist's downfall or vice versa, like is, or whoever the protagonist has to defeat, I am so hooked into the villain's point of view as well that I don't know, that's what I crave. And maybe superhero films is just not where I'm going to find that. Maybe the genre is just about the hero prevailing. maybe if I went back to watch Iron Man 3 again, I could really hook into what Killian's like grand motivations are. Think about Star Wars or Harry Potter, where the threat is imminent. And even though the heroes prevail film by film or book by book, the greater threat still remains.
Hmm.
And even if Darth Vader is gone or certain Death Eaters are gone or whoever like the imminent threats are, there's still the Empire or there's still Voldemort or there's still whatever the force is that is the threat.
That multiple people will rally behind. Someone will pick up that cause.
Yeah, like they pass the baton kind of to the next.
Yeah.
Hero to the next generation. And so it's like, it's never completed.
Whereas with these, yeah, you're so right. We're just presented with this one person with one set of motivations, and they're inevitably going to be pretty surface. John Voth reading Harry Potter.
Yeah.
He's been doing live readings of Harry Potter on YouTube. I highly recommend you all check it out. The other night, put it really well. He said the best plays and the best books, the best writing, the most interesting arguments are when both sides are presented equally compelling.
So you can't just write from whoever your protagonist's view is. You have to figure out like and play that motivation from the other side equally as strong to give your protagonist something to really push against.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I sound so pompous. I think that there is a lot of artistry in these films, and they do go into the protagonists a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I wonder if this is even characteristic of the comic books too, that you're reading a comic book and who's the villain this time? Oh, this guy has 12 legs. What's gonna happen?
Well, I had a thought as you were talking about the villains lacking sympathetic motivations, and we really saw the rise of superhero comics in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And at that time, there were very clear lines of perceived good and bad. The US was very much its own hero, and it very much had its own villains. And so they had a very black and white view of us good, them bad.
Well, you have to dehumanize the villain.
Absolutely.
To go to war.
Yeah. You can't present the villain with a compelling argument because then you might not want the hero to beat them. And when that villain is a representation of anti-American ideals.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was really intentional that they weren't painted as sympathetic. So a lot of these characters, these writers for the films are having to create reasons for them to become sympathetic. And I can see the work. Like Killian, we see how he got to where he is. He starts off as being stepped on by everybody. Nobody pays attention. He's got big ideas. Yeah,
if Tony had gone up to the roof, would he have turned into the hot fire guy?
Totally. I mean, talking about making his own demons, that's exactly it right there. And so we see how Killian got to where he was bullied. And so he is striking back against his bullies. So the motivation is there, but because we don't have a long time to get into them, and we don't have any time to get to know them, it's just surface motivation where we go, oh, I see how you got to where you are. It's not,
yeah.
Oh, I could kind of get on board with what you're thinking about.
Well, and we have one movie that's around 2 hours long where our main focus is on the hero and their development, which is great. So we don't spend a lot of time with the villains. And even I've noticed in a few of these films, there's one baddie, but then there's the real baddie.
Mm.
Like in this one, we think it's this Mandarin guy. And so for the first half of the movie, we think that this psychopath is the villain of the film. And then we find out that it's a front and that it's being manufactured on U.S. soil to instill fear and distrust and enmity and all these things. Again, like anti-Middle East, it seems like what were those videos?
You know,
there were like just ruthless murders of people on their knees. You know, I was like, really? We're just showing this?
But I think it was used in a really clever way, that it was intentionally done that way. Killian intentionally was using the symbol of a Middle Eastern terrorist,
yes,
to instill fear and to play upon people's already inbred fears.
For sure, but that's such an easy target.
But
it just sows further enmity between the US and the Middle East. I know that's what Killian is doing, but it's also what Marvel's doing.
Sure. I see what you're saying.
It's feeding us this easy target of, mm-hmm, yeah, we don't like those guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Those are villains.
But looking back on it now, you know, the first Iron Man 12 years ago, sure, through a lens now. But when it came out in 2008, I don't think a whole lot of particularly US moviegoers were going, that's pretty anti-Muslim.
For sure. And, you know, one of my favorite movies in the 90s was Air Force One.
Yeah.
Which was so, I mean, I can't even explain how terrible and cliche it is. But Gary Oldman plays like an Eastern European terrorist,
mm-hmm,
from some made up Eastern European country. But I just remember being like, yeah, those are bad guys, because mm-hmm, listen to their accents. That gets in there subliminally to our psyches and to our collective consciousness of distrusting the other. And
so you're saying less time devoted to
the Mandarin plot,
the Mandarin terrorist aspect, and more time devoted to getting to know the actual villains of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when we finally meet Ben Kingsley as, you know, the actor that he is, he's terrific. He's so funny, and I want to spend time with him and know more about, mm-hmm, him. But also you go, oh, well, now if I watch it again, that whole part is not scary. That's not the threat. It's just a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's the point. That's what the writers were doing, is like, this is a distraction. And that's what Killian's doing too. Look over here while I do all these things over here. But I don't even know, what was he trying to do? He was just trying to make more fire people?
Well, he was using the Mandarin television persona to play off the accidental explosions of the extremis test subjects.
What's his super goal?
To have a monopoly on the war on terror and own the United States. That's what it seemed like.
Well, and then he injected Pepper. What's the point with that? Was he just trying to do that to draw Tony in? Why didn't he just lock her up somewhere?
He injected Pepper because he wanted Tony to help him perfect the formula, and he knew that Tony, or he hoped that Tony would do it, because there's a chance that Pepper would explode if Tony didn't figure it out.
Okay, you see what I mean about it being convoluted? I did not get that. And maybe maybe I'm looking for so much more.
Yeah.
But these are just my thoughts.
Just going back to the whole Mandarin Ben Kingsley bit, I really like what they did with it, actually. Like, I like that they put in the terrorist aspect to fake out the audience, too. Not only fake out, here's the villain. Oh, not really, here's the real villain. But fake out, like, play on the audience's preconceived ideas of who a villain is.
Mm-hmm.
Even play on the preconceived ideas of who a villain is in an Iron Man film. Now, yes, you're absolutely right. Can we get away from that trope so we don't keep instilling it in audiences?
Mm-hmm.
I also just really like the twist, because it's Ben Kingsley and he's so good.
Yeah, he's phenomenal.
A lot of people hated that when the film came out, because the Mandarin is a pretty big character in Iron Man. He's also Chinese in the comics, so that was also a casting choice thing that people were like, why haven't you cast it appropriately? Which I agree with.
Yeah, I was a bit, his name is the Mandarin.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of people really hated that twist, because the Mandarin is such a well-known comic book character. But I loved it. Not just for Ben Kingsley. I just like the twist that,
it's funny,
as Tony realizes he's been faked out, we, the audience, also realize we've been faked out, and we also were drawn in by the stereotype of a terrorist.
Yeah, it makes us kind of confront our own stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
But time to move on from that trope.
Yeah.
You're right.
I mean, the acting and directing is all really great in all these films, and that's fully enjoyable to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, when I go to think of a summary, I'm like, ugh. I liked the scene with, I can't remember the actor's name, but in the van, the news truck.
Oh, yeah.
The super fan guy.
Yeah.
You know, they infuse humor into these films really well, I think. Especially when it's when superheroes and the public interact.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just watching superheroes being badass all the time. It's also kind of watching them be frustrated because of just regular people trying to figure stuff out and be starstruck. And
well, yeah, fame. Like, they deal with superhero fame in this a little bit. And mm-hmm. Tony is the face of that for sure.
Well, and he hasn't made any effort to hide from the public.
Yeah.
You know, he's not trying to be incognito as Tony Stark. In fact, it seems like he's so concerned with how he suits up so that it is a spectacle. And it gets better and better and better.
Mm-hmm. His ego has to continually feed itself.
Yeah. How do we wind this up?
Brian Tyler did the music for this one.
Okay.
And this isn't my favorite of his work. I love Brian Tyler as a composer. I think this film is great. He does some great work. It's not incredibly memorable until I actually sat down and actively listened to the soundtrack for this film. I couldn't have told you what it sounded like or what the main theme was. I heard an interview with him where he talked about the structure of this. We'll hear his work later on. He does another Marvel film.
Uh-huh.
And that one I do really like. So he was comparing these two, and I won't talk about the other one. But with this one, he was talking about writing it in a very structured 4-4 feel, because Tony has to work within rigid structures of technology. And I really appreciated his attention to that detail. He was specific with how he approached just starting to write a piece. And this film kind of combines the first and second Iron Man films. The first one had a ton of guitar and yeah, like heavy metal feel. The second one was really marchy and traditional, which mm-hmm. didn't quite work. This one combines a bit of the two. You've yeah, got some right. marchiness, but you also have a rock band guitar kit underneath it all. It's kind of a happy medium of both worlds. Particularly the credits music, I think, is great.
I need to start paying closer attention to the scoring. I want to remind myself to listen closer, because I didn't really notice until the credits. And I went, oh, this is the kind of music we've been listening to this whole time.
That's why I do love to always sit through credits, not just because there's the post-credits scene, but because the composer will write an end credits cue, and that is often a summary of the main theme and a couple of the others peppered in, and you get to hear a summary of here's what you heard in the film. And then they move on to other cues that they just play over the rolling credits. Because I'm not paying attention 100% of the time, all the time. I'm paying attention to the emotion of the scene. And the music is just elevating that. I'm not going, I'm being cued to think this because mm-hmm. the music's doing this. So you're not wrong to not be listening.
Roll the music now.
Roll credits.
Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe and leave us a review. Let us know what you think. And you can follow us at MCU and Me Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. See you next time.